Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Katsuhiko Takahashi, Minister of the Permanent Mission of Japan to the United Nations. I welcome all of you to the side event titled Sustainable Development Goals as a Driver for Transdisciplinary Research and Education, a view from the Nature article authors, co-hosted by the Permanent Mission of Japan and Australia. We have the honor to have the presence of Permanent Representative of Hungary, Ambassador Csaba Kurusi, co-chair of the SDG Open Working Group, to this event, despite his busy schedule. We also want to express appreciation to Professor Norichika Kanie from the Tokyo Institute of Technology for taking initiative to hold this event together with his colleagues, Professor Dave Griggs, Professor Mark Levy, and Ms. Faye Leon. Strengthening the interface and dialogue between science and policy and designing goals based fully on sound scientific evidence are crucial points in the context of the ongoing SDG Open Working Group and the post-2015 development agenda. The government of Japan attaches great importance to these points as well. Recently, the report of the high-level panel of eminent persons on the post-2015 development agenda has been issued. Also, Sustainable Development Solution Network has recently released the report that contains illustrative goals and targets. The project we are going to introduce today represents an effort on the part of the scientific community to introduce its input to the SDG process. And it was conducted by the group of scientists at the International Council for Science and funded by the government of Japan. The results of a study conducted by Mr. Kanie's group were published in the journal Nature in March. As far as I know, this article is one of the first reports that presented concrete and comprehensive goals for the SDGs, and I will remember reading this article with great interest when it was published. We sincerely hope that today's discussion can serve as a useful input to the discussion in the SDG Open Working Group. So now I give the floor to Mr. Peter Belseji, Minister Councillor of the Permanent Mission of Australia, to make an opening remark as one of co-sponsors.
Thank you, Mr. Takahashi, and good afternoon, panelists, distinguished guests and colleagues. I'd especially like to thank the Government of Japan for offering for Australia to co-host this important event. I think part of the value of the Sustainable Development Goals Open Working Group is that we get to hear the views of other member states on what their priorities are and their own thoughts on what the post-2015 agenda might look like. But it's also important, it's a great opportunity for us to hear also too from the broader community, particularly the scientific community, as they try to expand our ideas of what the post-2015 and the Sustainable Development Goals framework should look like and the evidence base that should underpin that. And I guess in that context, we're very pleased to be here today to discuss the very thought-provoking article in the journal Nature, of which one of Australia's own leading thinkers, Professor Dave Griggs, contributed to. I think the article provides a very interesting conceptualisation of how we could better integrate the unfinished work of the MDGs with environmental and social considerations. And it's articles and ideas like these which will help us move beyond the standard rhetoric of integrating the three pillars of sustainable development, which we've been talking about now since Rio 20 years ago, but really not come to grips with actually implementing it. And I think these articles help us move beyond that into thinking about how we do integrate those three pillars in a meaningful way. Distinguished guests, today is the last day of the fourth session of the Open Working Group, and I guess one of the most important tasks that the Open Working Group must do over the next year or so is not only to understand the issues we need to address, but the interlinkages between them. We can only do that well if we engage scientists, experts and stakeholders, particularly those with a transdisciplinary approach. I thank you and I look forward to the discussions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belseji, for the remarks. And now I invite Ambassador Kurusi to introduce the current status of the discussion of the Open Working Group and its relation with the science.
Thank you much, Ambassador, and thank you for the Government of Japan and Australia for hosting this event. And I feel very much honoured, but at the same time I feel humbled being a layman among scientists. I really don't know what I'm doing here, but but I try to give you a little bit of insight what we try to go after in the Open Working Group. We, as you may know, we are still not in the negotiating phase. We are still in the phase of creating a common knowledge base, where science has a particularly important role. How we try to move forward, what is the logic we are following? First, we need to keep, we need to ask ourselves, why is it necessary to go for a more sustainable development? What does it compel to change a paradigm, what we had until now? If we try answering that question, we have to tackle some sub-questions immediately. So what are the problems? What kind of challenges we want or we need to fix? The second, perhaps, what does it take to make a transition in terms of institutions, in terms of knowledge, in terms of capabilities, in terms of means of implementation, money, and organization? Third, what would be the price of inaction? If we would lower the ambition level, if we would just take that, okay, let's do it as business as usual, maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, what kind of price we are going to have to pay for that? And last but not least, which is a political one, not a scientific one, what will be, at the end of the day, what will be the ambition level of our governments? But that will be very much determined by the data and the information provided by science. Let me come back to that. Let me also mention five key points which are determining now our thinking while moving ahead, why we need to go for a change. First of all, today we are about 7.2 billion on the Earth, reaching 8 billion, maybe a little bit more by 2030. And during the last 100 years, our population has quadrupled. The first 100,000 years, we reached a certain level, and the last 100 years, we quadrupled that. It's actually four times more than 100 years ago. We became the main factor shaping the future of planet, as it was very clearly indicated in the Nature article as well. We are today a different society. We are mostly urban, and we are going even more to be urban. We are a consumer society, and we shape the future of the planet we want, whether we want or not. The second, we all want and we all deserve a decent life, much more decent than many had the fate to have decades or hundreds of years ago. We want to create conditions where every community and every individual will have opportunity to contribute to the growth and enjoy the benefit of the growth. But certainly, what kind of growth, our scientists will tell us. The third, this equitable growth will have to rely on the same or sometimes declining natural resources, what was available hundreds of years ago. They are not going to multiply. We are multiplying. So obviously, the equations are not matching each other. The fourth, there is now obviously a common will to seek joint solutions. We feel the momentum. Some scientists, friends of mine, when talking about these subjects, said that you have the unique opportunity. History is speaking to you. Don't miss it. If you miss it, it will be missed for a very long time, and you will be blamed for that. All of us will be blamed for that. And the fifth point, it is possible. It is possible to make the shift. It is possible to make the paradigm shift. It is the first attempt in the history of the UN that all the stakeholders came together, all the stakeholders take their responsibilities, be them governments, civil society, academic community, industry, and they all bring their contributions. Well, it remains to be seen at the end of the day what kind of compromise, as usual we do political compromises, what kind of compromise we are going to shape. But obviously, there is a joint will and there is a chance. So what kind of development we would like to see? A balanced growth, maintenance of human, social, natural, built and financial capital. If we miss one of them, the bubble will burst. Most of the proposed SDGs will require a leap in the technology. We cannot make it on the level of the today's technology. We need to progress very rapidly, be it food security, be it energy system, be it pharmaceuticals, health, medical technology, economic models, information technology, monitoring, data processing. Sometimes the science can advise us what are the problems lying ahead, but obviously science technology needs also make the frog leap to deliver the solutions. So what would we like to receive from the science? What would we like to expect from the science? 6 points, six very short points. Please help thinking in complex systems instead of focusing on isolated problems. Second, please provide us with objective data on risk factors, their interlinkages, and consequences if we don't take them seriously. Three, please indicate the danger zones ahead, the tipping points, and if you can, indicate what is behind or beyond the tipping points. Fourth, inform us on time frames we need to keep in mind. Fifth, inform on scientific feasibility of projected goals and their consequences. We would like to have a consultation with our scientific team when we concretely design the SDGs, to ask them to put a reality check on what we offer. And last but not least, please help developing technologies necessary for the shift. It's a lot, I know, a lot of demand, but please do help us. Thank you much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Crossi, and thank you very much for specifying the request to science communities. So now I move on to the presentation by science community, and I invite Professor Kanye and his colleagues to talk about the findings of their study. So let me give a role of moderator to Professor Kanye from now on. So Professor Kanye, please.
Thank you very much, Minister and Ambassadors, for your kind introduction. I'd like to start with my presentation on the main findings of the Nature paper. And I also want to present you some of the recent research programs that we are trying to develop in Japan. And then I'd like to introduce some of my colleagues to introduce individually on different issues on the scientific findings on sustainable development goals. In the title of my presentation, I put the word transdisciplinary research and education. I think this transdisciplinary idea is very important and very relevant for SDG issue. Transdisciplinary is the collaboration between scientists, but not only natural and social scientists, but also we try to work together with stakeholders on finding solutions, and that is not what science has been good at so far. But the program will be introduced more concretely by Professor Dave Griggs later on. There is now reorganizing the scientific program on global environmental research, and one of the core principles is this transdisciplinarity. So we are quite eager to work with you, stakeholders, including the government representatives. Next one, please. Earlier this March, a research group led by Dave presented possible sustainable development goals and six initial ideas about sustainable development goals in the nature. And in that article, we highlighted two points. Next one, please. One is the redefinition of sustainable development. Sustainable development that we probably all are aware of very well is the concept provided by Brundtland report in as early as 1987. But after that, the development has been progressed quite well and quite substantially, and especially economic development, we achieved quite a lot. But that also gives lots of pressure to the Earth. So rather than focusing on three pillars of sustainable development, we thought that, among other things, Earth's life support system is the precondition that makes it possible to develop further social and economic aspects of sustainable development. And that leads to redefine the concept of sustainable development to be presented in the green part in this slide, which leads to development that meets the needs of the present while safeguarding Earth's life support system on which the welfare of current and future generations depends. This is a kind of goal that we should be aiming at. And in order to reach that goal, we try to articulate a methodology to present it, to present integrated goals. And we came up with six sustainable development as the first step to consider sustainable development goals. Next one, please. These six sustainable development goals came in combination between human well-being and consideration of safeguarding the Earth's life support system. So on the one hand, we had Millennium Development Goals, and eight Millennium Development Goals are embedded there. On the other hand, we have so-called Global Sustainability Objectives, which is about Earth, safeguarding the Earth life support system. And we tried to include many different issues by addressing six sustainable development goals. Next one, please. And by doing that, we came up with six goals, which is first, thriving lives and livelihoods. Second, sustainable food security. Third, it's about water. Fourth, about clean energy. Fifth, healthy and productive ecosystems. And sixth, governance for sustainable societies. This is our initial output, but this is not the end point. We face some future work, which is about, first of all, integrating governance aspect into each goal. We put at this stage governance for sustainable societies as a sixth goal, but as a governance expert by myself, we think that each of these five sustainable development goals include different aspects of governance, and that is not well articulated in the current form of six sustainable development goals. And we should integrate those governance aspects into this five sustainable development goals. And that's the future task that we are trying to do in the science community. Also, in the earlier picture, one of the bases of coming up with six sustainable development goals is MDGs. Of course, MDG should be the basis for further development of sustainable development goals and overall post-2015 development goals. But in argument of MDGs, Millennium Development Goals, there have been many development also in the development arena. So more input from development studies should be integrated into these six sustainable development goals. And that's the second challenge that we are facing. Thirdly, as I pointed out earlier, transdiscipline approach is very important to take some step forward, which is about collaboration with the United Nations process and stakeholders. That is not so much included in the current approach, but in order to make the goals on the ground, we need to develop further the goals based on the collaboration with various different stakeholders. Of course, science should not be intervened or influenced too much by politics, but collaboration is very important, so we should find a way to work together. Next one, please. So these future tasks are the tasks that we are trying to develop further in the project called Project on Sustainability Transformation Beyond 2015, which is funded by the Minister of Environment of Japan. This is a three-year project with the objectives, next one please, to contribute to the post-2015 development goals and its process. But one of the objectives is to create a new community, epistemic community, what we call, bringing together people working on development issues and environmental issues, which is not necessarily working together in the past, but we think it's very important to bring them in together. Next one, please. So in the architecture, this is a little bit complicated picture, but in the architecture of this project, on the one hand, we have people and researchers working on environmental sustainability on the one hand, and on the other hand, we have people working on human well-being aspect and try to bring them together in integrated manner. We also have a strong team working on environmental governance and sustainable development governance, and we are working in collaboration with our system governance project on this issue. Next one, please. We are also collaborating with several different institutions throughout the world in working on this issue. One of them is Earth Negotiation Bulletin's team, which will be introduced to you later on in this side event. Next one, please. There are several key messages that I'd like to deliver to you as outcome of this project. This project is just starting now, but we found several important items to be addressed. One is setting global universal goals is an important aspect of SDG, and human well-being is an important element, and human well-being should be as a primary focus. But also planetary well-being is important, as we emphasized in the Nature paper, because human well-being, planetary well-being can become an enabling condition to all development issues. Next one, please. So we want to focus on these issues. And next one, please. And we have one before. Sorry. Oh, there's one slide missing. But we also want to emphasize on the resilience, which is also coming from the governance community. In Japan, we went through Great East Japan earthquake 2 years ago, and earthquake, tsunami, and Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster made me, many Japanese, to think about the importance of resilience. And this is a quite important element for keeping sustainability. So we also, in this project, want to focus on the resilience issue. And finally, transdiscipline approach is also very important for realizing sustainable development in the future. And last one, please. So we are just starting this project, but we are trying to think about integrating different aspects of sustainable development into more integrated post-2015 agenda. There are four kinds of issues that we can think of. One is the issue that is related to human well-being, but not so direct impact could be provided on the management of planetary well-being. We also have planetary well-being issues, which is not so much which doesn't have so much direct impact on human well-being. And most of those issues are addressed in multilateral environmental agreements. So leaving those two out of the scope in the ongoing project, we want to focus more on the issues on development that have direct consequences to planetary well-being, and also issues on planetary well-being that have direct consequences to the state of basic human needs. So these two issues are something that we would like to address, highlight, and work together in the next 2 years and possibly 3 years as well. With that, I would like to end my presentation, and I would like to invite Professor Dave Griggs, who will be presenting you more detailed concept about the issues presented in the Nature paper. He's the lead author of this.
Thank you, Norichka. So I'm going to give a bit more detailed explanation about some of the findings in the Nature paper. But the question is, we're talking about sustainable development here, and the key to that is development. So we're talking about poverty alleviation and all of the issues that go around that. So why can't we just carry on trying to get our way out of that development issue in the way that we have before? And so if we can have the next slide. What I'm going to say first of all is that really the rules of the game have changed. Some of the population increases that Ambassador Kurosi mentioned, if you look at the graphs, you can't see what these say, but it's things like population, total GDP, total investment, damming of rivers, water use, fertilizer consumption, urban population, paper consumption, urban transport, international tourism, even the growth of McDonald's restaurants. But the things that to look for there is that all of those graphs have exactly the same shape. So they all go fairly flat, and then from around about 1950 onwards, they just shoot on up. And the consequences of that, if we actually look at how the natural system, the Earth system and environment is responding, you can see exactly the same shape. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking about greenhouse gas concentrations of carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, whether we're talking about the state of the oceans, surface temperatures, numbers of floods, damage to ocean ecosystems, the damage to coastal zone infrastructure, coastal zone biogeochemistry, global biodiversity loss. The natural system is responding to those human drivers in exactly the same way. The curves have exactly the same shape. Another way of expressing that is if we look at total human impact as a measure of population times affluence times technology across the three axes, next slide, please. Sorry, next slide. You can see right down at the bottom apex of that cube, a very small box. That's the total impact of us as human beings in 1900. Almost indecipherable from that at the bottom of that apex is another box, which is 1950. And then you've got the total box, which is 2011. So you can just see the growth of the human impact on the natural system that's taken place over the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century. So that's the reason we can't go on developing in the way that we have developed, because human beings are now the prime driving force on the planet. And that has led a group of scientists to, next slide please, to look at some of the boundaries of the natural system and to say that we're already probably exceeding some of the sort of safe operating space of some of these boundaries. For example, in terms of biodiversity loss, in terms of climate change, and in terms of biogeochemistry of the oceans. So as well as having this development challenge, if we don't look at these environmental considerations, the chances are that any future development gains will be undermined by the damage to the environment. So we won't be able to continue to draw on that natural environment, which is the way that we've continued to develop up to the present. Future gains will be lost because of the damage that we're doing to the natural environment. Next slide, please. So as Norichika said, we came up with this paradigm for sustainable development, where the economy is embedded and serves society, and then society sits within a finite Earth life support system. And if we, next slide please, if we look at the sort of timeline of this, the picture on the left-hand side is sort of 1900, and what you can see is that the population is very small, so society is very small, the economy is very small, and so the Earth was essentially infinite. So we could draw on all the natural resources that the Earth had available to us. And that was a perfectly legitimate strategy because those resources were, abundant. Even in 1950, things hadn't changed very much. But now we are starting to draw on and starting to reach the limits of some of those Earth system boundaries. And what you can see here is that the economy circle can grow, the society circle can grow, but the environment circle can't grow. We've only got one Earth, so we're continually to push out onto those boundaries. So we're here on the right-hand side, but actually, next slide, so, and next, and the next. So what we came up with then was to say, if we had to try, in addition to things like the Millennium Development Goals, which look at our development aspirations, if we also had to look at our environmental aspirations, what would they be? And we came up with a set of sustainability objectives. And I won't go into the details of them here because of time considerations. But essentially to map those two. And then to say, can we actually integrate those into a common set of goals? Because if we look at them separately, then often they work in conflict and there are trade-offs between them. So, for example, if we want to increase food production, you might want to cut down rainforest. But if we want to preserve biodiversity, then you want to plant rainforest. So how do you manage those two things? The way you manage them is to integrate them together. And that was what caused us to come up with these set of six sustainable development goals, which you've already had outlined. Next slide, please. So thriving lives and livelihoods, and again, I won't read them in detail. Sustainable food security, sustainable water security. Next slide. Universal clean energy, healthy and productive ecosystems, and governance for sustainable societies. And so in looking at that sort of graphic now, you can see how each of these sustainable development goals integrates across the economic, social, and environmental pillars of sustainability, so that no longer are they separate, they are integrated together. And what I really wanted to focus on here is some of the thinking that we've actually gone into beyond the Nature paper. And so by looking at, next slide, by looking at these, you can see how these six goals along the sort of horizontal there are able to integrate a lot of both the Millennium Development Goals and those global sustainability objectives. Next slide. So there have been a number of proposals now for sustainable development goals. First, so we have the Millennium Development Goals, which already exist, and they're there and they're colour-coded. Then you have the Nature paper, which we're talking about here with its six goals. We have the Sustainable Development Solutions Network and its set of suggested goals. And we have the High-Level Panel and its set of suggested goals. And one of the things that is most striking is the similarity between them all. In particular, between the Nature paper and the High-Level Panel. Our top one there, Thriving Lives and Livelihoods, if you simply split that out into four goals of ending poverty, promoting education, empowering women, and promoting quality healthcare, then that is essentially the High-Level Panel top four goals. The next three are identical. You'll notice the blue, grey, and pale blue are identical to the goals in the Nature paper. And then our goal for sustainable governance for sustainable societies, again, has been expanded a little in the High-Level Panel paper. And in fact, it's so uncanny that they even appear in the same order and use some of the same wording. So I don't know whether they did draw upon the Nature paper, but as a scientist, looking at the chances of that happening by chance, it's really quite vanishingly small, I would have to say. So the similarity between these goals is really quite striking. But as I say, the key message that we came up with in the Nature paper was that we have to have integrated goals. Otherwise, these trade-offs will pull against each other. And so what we're now looking at is, can we also come up with integrated targets? So that when we set these targets, can we also look at ways of setting these targets in a way that manages these trade-offs? And I'm just going to give three examples here. Next slide, please. And in these targets, what we've done, and these are not fixed yet, this is very much in current thinking. So if we take our second sustainable development goal there, sustainable food security, there is a social target there, a development target of increasing food availability. So what we've said is, for example, what if we want to double accessibility for food? We've got a growing population, growing to 9 billion people by 2050. We're going to have to increase the amount of food we produce. But we also have a number of environmental targets. We don't want to have any more land converted because we need to preserve that for environmental reasons. We want to limit the amount of nitrogen that we remove from the atmosphere, the amount of phosphorus to flux into the oceans, the limit the amounts of water we use for agriculture. So how do we manage those two things? So if we actually look at it, one way to do that would be to reduce the waste, food waste, by increasing the fraction that's getting to market and reducing post-consumption losses, and increasing food production intensity. So now, instead of having a social target and an environmental target, you now have a target which manages allows you to achieve both those things at the same time. Likewise, for water production, if we want to increase the amount of water for production of food and fibre and industrial products, but we also want to limit the amount of runoff from our rivers, how can we manage those two things? We have to increase the water use efficiency in order to be able to manage that. So let's set a target for water use efficiency. Same for energy. If we want to increase energy production, because the world needs more energy, but equally we have to limit the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are produced by that energy, then we can do that by decreasing carbon intensity and by increasing the energy intensity. So again, we can manage that trade-off by setting a target which integrates both the social and environmental elements of these goals. So we believe it is possible to come up with a unified framework where both the Millennium Development Goals in a continued form, plus these global sustainability objectives, are able to be integrated into a common set of goals and also a common set of targets, which would allow the sort of synergies and the trade-offs between, because there are synergies as well as trade-offs, where there are some win-wins between the environmental objectives and the development objectives. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, for your presentation. Next, I'd like to invite Dr. Mark Levy from the Center for International Science Information Network, CSIN, of Columbia University.
to push on this.
I have to unpush.
Okay. Thank you, Norichika. You can go to the next slide, please. So in terms of truth in advertising, I was not an author of the Nature paper, but I've enjoyed very much interacting with the authors and participating with them in a number of other Sustainable Development Goal projects. So I'm going to be making my own observations that reflect a number of interactions with the Nature paper authors and others, as well as my own experiences. So I want to start with a kind of ambition. If you imagine a transformation as profound as what occurred in this meeting here, where U.S. Senator Jesse Helms, who had spent most of his career trying to block progressive foreign aid coming from the U.S., and Bono, who spent much of his career trying to promote progressive foreign aid, were able to reach an agreement which led to Helms reversing a number of his longstanding oppositions, which led to, in this case, release of significant amounts of aid, of U.S. foreign aid to combat HIV/AIDS. It's this kind of success that we want to replicate across a large number of policy areas and to build on and do even more with. I would argue in this case what we have is a clear vision in this policy area, specific actions that actors were being called upon to engage in, and a framework for making the benefits of taking those actions really clear to a range of people who disagreed with each other on almost everything, but were able to find agreement on this. For the Sustainable Development Goals, I would argue we do not yet have those conditions. And so one of our tasks is to figure out how we can create them. Next, please. This is a summary graphic from the UN Environment Program's most recent Global Environmental Outlook. It's a very depressing temperature taking of how well we're doing at meeting the environmental goals that we've set for ourselves. The picture is even worse than this because there's a large selection bias at work where there's a number of environmental goals we probably should be setting for ourselves, but we're so ignorant we don't even know that, and so they're not present here. But in this evaluation of 90 identified international environmental goals, no progress at all on more than half of them, only modest progress on a bunch of them, on most of them. Only a tiny, tiny minority was there significant progress. And many of them, even though there was a goal, there was no effort to actually measure it. So you couldn't even say if there was progress or not. So business as usual, this practice of governments trading goals with themselves and then doing nothing to measure and monitor and assess is certainly not working. Next, please. So it's as if we're, you know, flying a complicated aircraft with all the instruments taped over. Next, and then just, you know, wishing for the best. So that's clearly irresponsible. Next, please. And again. One more time. Now, we're not doing this because we're evil or stupid. We're stuck in this position in large part because we face a complex challenge. So sustainability is an emergent property of a set of interconnected, multi-scale systems. And so it's more complicated than simply setting a single target on a single issue among a discrete, small, well-defined number of actors. The science of sustainability has uncovered an increasingly complex picture of what makes it unravel and how hard it is to put back on track. So the conclusion on the part of many of us is that we need to start reshaping our governance structures so that they reflect this dynamic. So instead of continuing to do the single sector national governments trading commitments with each other process for the sake of a set of phenomena that have these other characteristics, we should change the governance process so it is inherently mirroring the multi-scale, multi-sectoral, complex phenomena. Next. So we need to think like a system instead of thinking like a state. There's a very famous book by the political scientist James Scott, which shows how many development initiatives fail because they don't take into account how nation states view the world. I think the scientific community would argue that now it's time to graduate beyond that and think like systems. So we need to look for policy intervention points which will transform the behavior of complex multi-sectoral systems. And if the systems are out of control, we need to look for opportunities to back up the causal chain and relieve pressure in the form of the driving forces that are impelling these systems as a whole into unstable territory. And we need to set goals around risks that are characterized by behavior of the systems which we find dangerous. Again, these are different ways of formulating policy goals than the world has been accustomed to when it comes to environment and natural resources. There are some aspects of this framework that are not alien to the international policy machinery, and we should try to build on some of those things. For example, I would argue that much of the economic machinery put in place at the end of World War II, in particular efforts to manage international monetary crises, have elements in common with this. Those were policy mechanisms that were inherently focused on managing complex systems. The targets were far from static. When they became static, they generated problems, and people recognized that and changed them. So I think we do have some historical knowledge on how we manage the world in this kind of way. We have not yet applied it for things like the SDGs. Next. So this is a summary slide from our expert group meeting in connection with a prior meeting of the Open Working Group. So I won't belabor this. Many of you may have seen this before. But if we want different kinds of policy, then we have to have different kinds of supporting mechanisms to engender it. Tighter linkage of science and policy. The historical caricature is you keep science and policy as separate as you can so that they don't infect each other. I think we need to find new ways to help them co-evolve. There's virtually no serious sustainability challenge that will be solved by governments talking to each other. These are multi-stakeholder problems, and so we need mechanisms that reflect that. These are inherently place-based problems. They're not generic, so we need to have policy mechanisms that reflect that. And then the last point is a bête noire of my own. Sustainability is a challenge that cannot be significantly advanced in a 15-year time frame. And I'm deeply disappointed with the high-level panel report, the Sustainable Development Solutions Network report, insofar as they fall short of setting long-term transformational goals. There's one reference to a 2050 goal in the SDSN report on energy and climate emissions and carbon emissions. There's no reference in the high-level panel. The talk is ambitious. The talk is transformational. The aspirations are there. But when they get to specific illustrative sustainable development goals, they're all benchmarked far too soon. And I realize the world is not organized in a way that where you can just simply flip a switch and have it start thinking long term. But I think it would be a big wasted opportunity if we didn't have at least one SDG process that had a very clear, longer-term focus that could have at least some potential to get things on the right track and from which we could learn. So we could see what makes for good policy practices for long-term transformation. Next, please. So there are lots of building blocks underway. They're poorly coordinated. One of the things I was asked to talk about was indicators. The indicator landscape is hopelessly primitive when it comes to rising to these challenges. But I think we do have the technology, the will, and the interest in doing this. We have to step it up so it scales up, it adds up to what we need. Next, please. I can't let this chance go by without at least pointing out some of the critiques of the planetary boundaries metaphor. I think there are many sustainability challenges which are completely outside of or parallel to the problem of exceeding planetary boundaries. And so while we do need to pay very careful attention to those boundaries because they will kill us if we're not careful, that's not the sustainability agenda. So this is just a portrait of one set of challenges. The graph on the upper left is the stock price of Apple, one of the most innovative, effective makers of cell phones. There are something like 11 billion mobile phones that have been made so far in the world. To the right of that graph is a effluent pipe in the Pearl River Delta, which makes about 60% of the world's cell phones and similar small consumer electronics. So that delta is being ruined through the effluent of the production process. The world is deciding it wants 11 billion cell phones. It's making them in one place and concentrating a set of activities which is destroying ecosystems there. In the lower left is the Northeast Democratic Republic of Congo, which is producing many of the rare earths that go into these things. Coltan is the most famous of them. Concentrating demand for one product, which can be supplied in one place through very destructive practices, leads to a set of challenges through a set of teleconnected processes. And then finally in the lower right, you have the dumping ground for a lot of these things. This is a slum outside Accra, Ghana, which is the world's largest repository for electronic waste. Many of these e-waste products are scavenged through by burning the refuse, and then the metals are then accessible to people. This is a problem which is ruining radically different landscapes in a process in which not a single planetary boundary is being broached. What we have to do next is recognize the drivers of these kinds of problems, the rise in consumption, the connection across supply chains, the ability of actors to diffuse responsibility, and these radically uneven capacities for managing. I would argue that these kinds of driving forces are present across a wide range of problem areas, and that we should expect those problems to get worse, not better. So while we should pay attention to planetary boundaries, this other kind of problem is going to continue to get worse in many ways. Next. So finally, what we need to do in terms of supporting effective SDGs is focus on points of policy intervention that will transform systems. We need to be drivers of systems, not responders to them. And we need to recognize that the old model of having governments negotiate solutions is simply not going to work. The points of responsibility, the ability to act, is far too diffuse. And so we need patterns of shared responsibility across multiple stakeholders to be able to do that. We need to recognize that these systems are complex enough that we're not going to be able to set simple short-term goals and then implement what's needed and then walk away. We're going to be observing systems that will change as we perturb them. And so we need to have robust, tight feedback mechanisms that link observations of how the systems are changing with science about why they're changing in that way, with adaptive policy mechanisms that respond to those changing insights. So finally, what we need is an indicator system that has surveillance and rapid response as one of its goals, because simply implementing policy measures will never be enough. Things will always go wrong in surprising ways, and we need a system that takes that into account. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. I think both Dave and Mark talks about more or less the same thing from different perspectives. Mark also highlighted the importance of long-term goals, as well as the short-term goals. Short-term in his term, I think, mentions 2030, but long-term is 2050 or longer-term target, as this is planetary. This issue is related to planetary issues. We also need to address longer term as well. And he also highlighted the importance of driving force. But in order to come up with better idea about, you know, integration of target, probably we need to bring different communities together to find synergies among different issues. And for that, IISD, International Institute for Sustainable Development, is working on integration of different communities. I'd like to invite Faye Leon for her presentation about her activity to bring different communities together to create sustainable community.
Thank you, Professor Kanye, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this event. I'm going to introduce some tools that we have been using at IISD to increase the flow of information among the parts of the sustainable development community, as you said. And it was very interesting to just hear from Professor Levy the historical view on how radical it can be to bring these arenas together. Next slide, please. I'll just talk a little bit about IISD, first of all. The International Institute for Sustainable Development is a non-governmental organization. It was set up by the Government of Canada in 1990, but now is an independent charitable nonprofit organization. And our key mission really is to provide information for policymakers. And to do this, we have offices in Canada and Switzerland, and then my program area reporting services is based here in New York. Next slide, please. Here is a quote from someone who's a researcher on the effects of the internet on people's lives. And the idea here is that we all use different filters to manage our information overloads. So we choose the TV channels we watch and avoid the other ones, which I won't name. The same with newspapers, our Twitter feeds that we choose. And so likewise, IISD is serving as a filter specifically for the sustainable development policy community. One thing that we hear a lot from people involved, particularly in these post-2015 processes, is that we need help mapping what's going on. People say, how do we make sense and assemble all the pieces of these processes? So the idea here is that too much information is not the problem. In fact, information and even an overload of it is a great thing. But what we do need are the right filters. So in order to play the role of an information filter well, I'm going to mention three rules that we believe we need to have. So you can go to the next slide. The first rule for playing the role of information curator well is to be trusted, to earn the trust of the people using your information. So many of you know us from the Earth Negotiations Bulletin, which is this report you're seeing on the screen, and that we are often found writing at the back of the negotiation rooms. So earning the trust of being a trustworthy information provider is the first rule. The second is to have access to the relevant information. You can go to the next slide. And this often means getting really close to the negotiations, and you can see in this image from our photographer, Leela Mead, that many of you know, we can get very close to key negotiations. Next slide. And the third rule is to present the information in a format that the audience can use. Next slide. This is a picture of a delegate using a sort of new format for us. This is a paper smart meeting, and not everyone, of course, has a mobile device. So in the absence of a big stack of paper or wireless devices, we decided to do huge printouts of our reports each day. So this is an example of how we're trying to reach people with the information they need. You can go to the next slide. So I'm talking about a strategy of information curation. How are we using that in the post-2015 process? One form that it's taken is this knowledge base. This is our newest online knowledge base. This is on the post-2015 and SDG processes. It's called Post-2015 Policy and Practice, and it's designed to track all the activities here in New York and around the world by international organizations, member states, NGOs, academics, researchers. And if you want to have your information included in the site, you can contact me. We write short summaries of what's going on. And then at the very, this is an example of a way we send out the information. It's a weekly or biweekly email compiling the latest post to the knowledge base. And at the very bottom, you're seeing upcoming events that comes from the calendar that's also constantly updated on the site. Next, please. Okay, so now I'm just going to give you a couple references for what I just discussed. This is the place you can find all our reports on the post-2015 thematic consultations that we attended in person. Next. And then I'm not going to leave this up long enough for you to use it, but you can come back to me. This is where you can find all our information online. Next. And then I had mentioned that we curate information and put it on the knowledge base, and these are the people that do it. It's some of our ENB writers from around the world that send us items for us to include. So it's just to show you sort of the process that we're using. Next, please. And this is my last slide and my last point. We're trying to facilitate information flow at the intergovernmental level, making sure people can find out what is happening. So there's one more tool that we've been using to do this. We've heard here about epistemic communities, and IISD has established a series of community lists that represent virtual epistemic communities. This began with our Climate L list, and that now has more than 27,000 subscribers. So now for the post-2015 and SDG process, we've established a community list called Post-2015L, and this is something anybody can join, and then any member of it can post an announcement that then reaches all the other subscribers. So this tool, community list, is our most open-ended, community-driven format that we've been using. And we're here today speaking about increasing the communication between researchers and policymakers. And it's a really clear option for doing that. We're looking for opportunities for science to influence the post-2015 processes. This is something that can facilitate that. It's a way to let both the science and the policy worlds benefit from the processes going on here at the UN. Next slide. That's the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Faye. And if I would add one more information, our project, this post-2015 project, will be working together to launch a new knowledge base on post-2015 issue. So that's all from the floor, from this podium. Now I'd like to open the floor for question and comments and more interaction between ourselves. Please.
Hi, my name is Molly Perchlick, and I'm a part of a graduate research program that's actually integrating policy and nitrogen science, and I'm representing a climate change initiative of the Unitarian Universalist UN office. And I would like to thank you for this panel because I think it's a very important issue to raise when dealing with sustainable development. Throughout the entire working group, we've seen sustainable development has brought up so many more issues, and it is a very complicated issue to incorporate economic, social, and environmental problems together. And so my question to you is to maybe, could you touch a little bit more on how we can bring groups of researchers and problem solvers together, policymakers, to address work together when they have different systems of working to solve these problems? And also, how can we convey some of Kasava, you mentioned that there were several needs of scientists, and so how can we convey those needs and the lack of knowledge that we have on specific issues to back to researchers? Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. I'm from the Mission of Mexico, and I wanted to, first of all, commend the organizers for bringing this perspective to the UN, not only because it integrates very successfully this interaction between science, environmental science, and the diplomatic and development community, which often has been painfully separate and disdainful of each other. As a scientist at the UN, this is something that I felt very, very directly. But also, it brings this very thoughtful and broad and rigorous approach at a time when all of these approaches, all these reports are coming together, and at the open working group, we're going to go into a more abstract, into a more focused, and Ambassador Corossi mentioned all of the tasks that we may need from science, but also from the system, from the technical support team and the facilitators, we may now need to ask them to integrate these approaches and perhaps suggest ways in which targets and indicators may be expressed. And in this regard, I think it's going to be very, very important to have this interaction between the UN system, all the different agencies, and the science community. Because the challenges that remain is how to ensure the universality, how to define the targets and the indicators, or how to choose them from the ones that are already there, and their interconnectedness, and what is still measurable and what is still to be measured. And that's what I wanted to ask you, if you can envision such an interaction, and how to, based on your work, how can you tackle these challenges of the universality of what targets can be defined for both the developing and the developed world, which sometimes is not very clear, and of all the different works that you have analyzed in that table that I hope you can share with all of us, between all the reports, how can we recognize specific targets and indicators? And also, as you mentioned, in the systems approach, how we can deal with the commons problems that sometimes many members of the group would prefer not to get into, that very touchy subject of climate change, oceans, and so on. And also the long-term goals. How would you help us tackle the long-term goals that you mentioned concretely? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's a very rich question. Gentleman from the second row, please.
Thank you. Bob Watson, representing the UK government. A comment and a couple of quick questions. I like the intercomparison of the various goals that Dave Grigg showed. I think that's very, very helpful. And if we could all have access to that, I think it'd be very useful. Couple of quick questions. You mentioned planetary boundaries, each of you in your talk, or many of you. Does goal number 2 of the Sustainable Development Solutions Network make any sense? And that is achieve development within planetary boundaries, when you yourselves have said we've exceeded most of them, at least on pollution, climate change, and biodiversity. So how can we achieve development within planetary boundaries if, as you correctly say, as a group of scientists, we've already exceeded them? So like a couple of comments on that, basically. The second question is, you all stress the need to bring together, and I agree 100%, policy formulation with the scientific community. Do you think that the proposed Future Earth research program that is now integrating the 4 big programs of IGBP, WCRP, IHDP, and diversity is the type of program that will give us the scientific basis that's needed for thinking beyond 2015? And while I agree with Mark about having long-term goals, most politicians can't think that. So what would you say should be a set of intermediate goals along the way?
Thank you very much for all 3 questions. Now I'd like to get back to the floor. Any answer that you'd like to address? Please, Dave, first.
I'll have a quick stab at 1 or 2 of them. The first one about how do we really get different disciplines to work together? That is a real challenge, because everything from, you know, as a scientist, you become an expert in science by learning more and more about something smaller and smaller. And that's completely the antithesis of what we're trying to do here. Government departments are organized along discipline lines. Universities are organized along departmental lines. Everything is organized along those discipline lines. But I think that is changing. I mean, now it is possible to carve out a career as an interdisciplinary scientist. And this now comes to Bob's question, which was, thank you for teeing that one up, Bob, because I was going to mention this. You know, things like Future Earth, which brings together the World Climate Research Programme, the International Geosphere Biosphere Programme, Diversitas, and the International Human Dimensions Programme, and has as an equal standing a science committee and a stakeholder committee, which involves stakeholders as an integral part of that science process. Those are the kinds of things that can start to break down these interdisciplinary barriers to start to get this interdisciplinarity working. In terms of the common but differentiated responsibilities, how would we get different targets which apply across, you know, both developed and developing countries? That, again, is a really tricky issue. I don't think it's possible to try and come up with individual country targets for any of these goals. That's just not going to work. The climate negotiations have shown how impossible that is. So the approach that we're taking is to see whether we can come up with goals which would be equally applicable across a range of, you know, developed and developing countries, so essentially relative goals, by adopting these ones where, you know, if you increase a percentage rate of efficiency gain or a fraction of this or something, so that all it would apply to all countries. And then I'll probably shouldn't answer the question that Bob was, and I have already had very long conversations about SDSN goal number 2, and we both agree that we have exceeded some planetary boundaries. And I'm not one to defend the planetary boundaries concept. I mean, there are no real artificial boundaries within the Earth system. But what it is a helpful construct to see that to allow people to look at there are dangers in terms of the direction that we are heading, and that there are consequences beyond which it would be difficult to get back from. So I don't think we need to fixate too much on the actual concept of planetary boundaries, but rather use it as a useful construct to help us move our sort of thinking in terms of the risks that we're facing.
Thank you, and I'd like to invite Ambassador Croce before he leaves here, because he has to prepare for the next session of Open Working Group.
Thank you much indeed. And could I come back just to the last sentence of David? Please help us and be very, very loud, telling us where are the danger zones. We need them. If we don't take it very, very clearly, that at the end of the day, and it comes back to the question of Mexico, we bog down in a political host rating. We are a negotiating forum. We are going to turn into a negotiating forum very soon. And there are good and bad traditions of negotiations in this house. If we choose the second one, then we miss the subject and we produce a paper. If we go for the first, then we can iron out a strategy based on your suggestions and on real data. And how to link the Open Working Group, the negotiation process with the scientific community, and how to make the feedback back and forth. Maybe it's not a big secret that 3 out of the scientists on the podium are members also of the so-called expert team. The UN had gathered the best brains in the world, asking them a number of questions. And they created a team. This team is informing us. They have come together before the Open Working Group started, and they keep contributing into the issue papers what you as member states keep receiving. But we are not stopping with that. When we approach November, December, so when it will be visible how we are going to finish the phase of creating the common knowledge base, we come back in person to our scientists, asking them, look, here we are. This is the huge bunch of proposals, what we have from the member states, up on the information, what you provided, other provided, and we think this might be the directions member states are opting for. what do you think? And we will ask them to be very rude. Thank you.
Thank you. So we are going to have a big hallmark. Mark, please.
Yeah, so I'll try to respect your time and answer these things quickly. First, regarding the question of how you bring groups together effectively from different traditions and perspectives, in my experience, this happens organically when you have a shared understanding of risk or of opportunity, which can mobilize people to either manage that risk or exploit that opportunity. So, for example, in the last few years, you've had a pretty profound change in the way many of the agricultural practitioners and scientists and policymakers have interacted, because they're now deeply worried about the risks in the global agricultural system, and they want to manage them better. They're not being, you know, forced to do this by any international process. They realize they need to manage these risks better. And I would argue that from the perspective of ecosystem services as supporting mechanisms for poverty reduction, you have similar kinds of opportunities. So it can't be imposed, but it does happen when people realize what they can get out of it. On the question of universality, I think it's a really mixed bag. It's good to have developed and developing countries share responsibility for the SDGs, but I think it would be a mistake to say that across the board, the goals should apply equally to all. The circumstances are so different. And this is true within developing and within developed countries as well as across the two groups. For me, a more helpful framework is managing global systems collectively. And so we acknowledge a shared responsibility for managing these systems, but each of us will have different things that we have to do along those lines. So, you know, a gigantic high capital corn farm in the U.S. is going to have to do different things than a smallholder in the Sahel. On the long-term goals, I think this is more of an art than a science, and I don't think we've got a good answer. Our repertoire of how we goose action today on a trajectory that will get us where we want to be 50, 100 years from now is very imprecise. But I think that you can imagine some characteristics which would be more helpful than harmful. So for me, the water security issue is something that lends itself to a more ambitious, longer-term time frame. So this is the problem of water security is going to deeply affect virtually the entire planet, you know, within 50 years. That's very, very clear. But we have the opportunity to see it today already. There's intertemporal variability and there's spatial variability. So if you wonder what will a failure to manage this problem look like, you don't have to invent it. You can go see it. Or you can just wait long enough and you'll have the New York City subways flooded, you'll have unprecedented droughts, et cetera. So it's not hard to get people motivated to want to prevent those problems as they would get worse under business as usual. And I think we know enough about the water problem to be able to decompose that into a set of shorter-term actions that can guide us. Whereas it would not be realistic to expect that in 15 years the world will be managing water sustainably, I think that within 30, that's probably within reach. I think I'll skip the future Earth. I think I agree with what Dave said. The planetary boundaries reference in the SDSN goal, I think, is communicating the opposite of its explicit content. To me, what it says is we're not going to take this stuff seriously. We're going to pretend that if we pay homage to planetary boundaries, we'll end up in the right place. It's playing the same role rhetorically that the Millennium Development Goal 7 on environmental sustainability did. It says, yeah, we know that stuff matters. We've got it written down. Don't worry about it. Don't bother us. So I think it's actually subversive in a bad way. We need to take these things seriously, and if we did, we would not have these throwaway catch-all kind of slogans. I just made a lot of enemies back home.
Thank you, Mark. So with this, I'd like to close this panel discussion, but we would like to carry on this conversation in the course of the Open Working Group as well as outside of this group. And part of the platform will be the IISD's new knowledge network. So I hope to interact with you in the future. There are 10 copies of the Nature paper that we mentioned earlier around here. So if anyone wants to look at this Nature paper, please come over after this session. With that, I'd like to bring the floor back to Minister Takahashi.
Thank you very much, Professor Kanye and colleagues, for the presentation. I really enjoyed the presentation, also the candid exchange of comments and questions. So maybe I should have allocated more time for questions and answers, and I have to take into consideration if we organize a similar event in the future. Anyway, we already passed the scheduled time, and before closing the side event, I give the floor to Mr. Katayama, Senior Coordinator of Global Environmental Division of the Japanese Foreign Ministry, to make a closing remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Takahashi. The time is, as he described, is running out, and maybe some of you have to run for the lunch. So I will be very quick. Until last Friday, another person was supposed to come here, but I now feel I was lucky to be here after having participated 2.5 days of the meeting of SDG's Open Working Group, because I could realize the roles of each stakeholder, and especially I enjoyed, and not only myself, but I think all the representatives from the government, all the government, listened very carefully. The presentations by professors and specialists and NGOs. And at the same time, I felt their devotion to the causes. And from that point of view, I'm pleased to be here together with the distinguished professors, four professors. And at the same time, I would like to extend warm appreciation to the government of Australia, who decided to co-host this fine event. The presentations of Professor Kanye, Professor Griggs, Professor Levy, and Professor Leon, all of them were very interesting, and to me, many of these presentations were eye-opening and very stimulating. And I think many of us will look forward to see the final report of the project, which is led by Professor Kanye. Before concluding, I'd like to extend appreciation to you, those people who came to this place, and please keep an eye on of Professor Kanye's project. And let me extend once again gratitude to the professors who took their time and who made fine presentations here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Katayama. And that's all for today's event. So now I close the meeting. Thank you very much for the participation. Thank you.